Good afternoon, brethren. Welcome to another Sabbath Bible study. This is part number 4 in a series of tapes that I have entitled, Who is Babylon? I've also discussed to a certain extent, what is Babylon? And today's subject is going to be wrapped up, hopefully, on this tape. And if there is a need for additional information with respect to the premise that I'm basing this discussion on, then I intend to write an article that will be more detailed than the information that I have presented on this series of tapes, and it will be made available to anyone who wants to request it. It won't be just sent out like a tape. So when that is completed, why, I'll be glad to let you know. And if you're interested and want to study further into this very absorbing and very intriguing subject of how the world is really run and how it's developed to the point that it is and what really goes on in the decision-making in the world behind the scenes, then you can just simply ask or request for your own copy of that when it becomes available. I want to pick up where I was on the last tape, and I'll just start by saying that as things begin to get near the boiling point at the end of the age, rumors are going to abound. The Bible says so. Babylon will pay little attention to them, but God tells his own people, during this time, just as Babylon is about to fall, in Jeremiah 51, beginning in verse 45, he says the famous words that we read in Revelation 18, verse 4, come out of her, my people. Now, this is in the Old Testament, and it said with respect to Babylon, run for your lives, run from the fierce anger of the Lord. Do not lose heart or be afraid when rumors are heard in the land. One rumor comes this year, another the next. Rumors of violence in the land and of ruler against ruler. When the leaders of Babylon finally become aware of the danger that they face, they are struck with shock and fear. God says, at that time, and this is in Jeremiah also, he says, look, an army is coming from the north, verse 41, and a great nation and many kings are being stirred up from the ends of the earth. The king of Babylon has heard reports about them, and his hands hang limp. Anguish has gripped him. Pain like that of a woman in labor, like a lion coming up from the thickets of Jordan to a rich pasture land. I will chase Babylon from its land in an instant. A little later in Jeremiah 51, we read, beginning in verse 29, Babylon trembles and writhes, for the Lord's purposes against her stand, to lay waste the land of Babylon. Babylon's mighty men will not fight. They remain in their strongholds. Their strength is exhausted. They have become like women. Her dwellings are set on fire. The bars of her gates are broken. One courier follows another, and messenger follows messenger to announce to the king of Babylon that his entire city is captured, and all the escape routes are blocked, the fortifications are burning, and the army is in panic. Through the prophet Isaiah, in Isaiah the 13th chapter, beginning in verse 6, God says, an oracle concerning Babylon, wail, for the day of the Lord is near. It will come like destruction from the Almighty. Because of this, all hands will go limp. Every man's heart will melt. Terror will seize them. Pain and anguish will grip them, and they will writhe like a woman in labor. They will look aghast at each other, their faces aflame. See, the day of the Lord is coming, a cruel day, with wrath and fierce anger, to make the land desolate and to destroy the sinners within it. Who will be end time Babylon's greatest enemy? Who will come from the east and from the north against her? God gives us the answer in the same 13th chapter of Isaiah, beginning in verse 17. Here's what we read. God says, "See, I will stir up against them," that's against Babylon, "the Medes, who do not care for silver and have no delight in gold. Their bones will strike down the young men. They will have no mercy on infants, nor will they look with compassion upon children. And Babylon, the jewel of the kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride, will be overthrown by God like Sodom and Gomorrah. Her time is at hand and her days will not be prolonged." The Medes. God says it will be the Medes who come against end time Babylon, precisely as it was the Medes who conquered ancient Babylon. Now, turn over to Jeremiah 51 and we have confirmation of this fact. Jeremiah 51 verse 11. God says, "Sharpen the arrows, take up the shields. The Lord has stirred up the kings of the Medes, because his purpose is to destroy Babylon. Lift up a banner against the walls of Babylon. Reinforce the guard, station the watchmen, prepare an ambush. The Lord will carry out his purpose, his decree against the people of Babylon." Babylon in the end time is going to be ambushed by the modern day Medes and their allies. A combination of many kings, the Bible says, from the north and from the east. Who are the Medes? Well, anciently they were the descendants of Madai. He was a son of Japheth and a grandson of Noah. You can read about him in Genesis 10, I believe, where the genealogies are given. The brothers of Madai were Magog, Gomer, Javan, Tubal, Meshech. His nephews were Tarshish and Kittim and Togarma. Now, these names ought to sound familiar if you do much study of Bible prophecy, because virtually all of them are mentioned as being joined together in the pivotal 38th chapter of Ezekiel, where a combine of eastern and northern nations are predicted to invade the land where God's people are dwelling safely in the latter days. Now, I don't have time on this tape to go into Ezekiel 38 and 39. But understanding this prophecy is paramount to putting the final pieces of the end time puzzle together. Perhaps this can be covered on a subsequent tape in this series or another one, a related series. But in the days before the establishment of the Babylonian Empire, the Medes had actually befriended Babylon in her struggle against the Assyrian hegemony. We covered that in probably on tape one of this series. In fact, a brigade of Median soldiers under the leadership of King Syaxes accompanied Crown Prince Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon at the fall of Nineveh in 612 BC. The Medes, however, soon separated from the Babylonians and returned home with their spoils of victory. Their association with Persia, you see, it's always characterized as the Medo-Persians or the Medo-Persian Empire. Their association with Persia occurred over a period of many years. In fact, the granddaughter of this same leader, Median leader, whose name was Syaxares, the name of his granddaughter was Mandane, and she was the mother of Cyrus the Great, ruler of Persia. In effect, Cyrus was half Mede. In 549 BC, he invaded Media from Persia, overthrew his own grandfather, whose name was Astyages, and established the Persian Empire. Under his dominance, Median influence strongly asserted itself. Cyrus made the Median capital of Ecbatana his own capital. Moreover, he adopted the system of government set up by the Median kings and retained Medes in high offices. In the biblical record, even though Cyrus was king in 539 BC, at the fall of Babylon, the invasion force was led by a man named Darius the Mede. And furthermore, throughout the book of Daniel, the term Medes and Persians is mentioned a number of times and reveals the prominence of the Medes in the word order that is used there. So we must remember that the coming of Cyrus the Great had been prophesied by Isaiah at least 150 to 175 years before it actually occurred, even down to the detail of actually calling him by name. You can read that at Isaiah 44:27. That the destruction of Babylon transpired in the manner and under the auspices that it did was no mere happenstance. Cyrus and the Medo-Persian armies were used by God to defeat the ancient Babylonians. They were the original kings of the East, who were able to come into and take the heretofore impregnable fortress of Babylon by drying up the Euphrates River, the identical event that is predicted in the book of Revelation to be repeated in the end time to make way once again for the kings of the East. Who are the Medes today? Who are the kings of the East in the 21st century? Who will come out of the East and North against end time Babylon? Anciently, the Medes lived on the western shores of the Caspian Sea, occupying territory that currently includes north and north central and northwestern Iran, the country of Azerbaijan, part of Armenia. You can look it up on a map for yourself. Through the centuries, many of the Medes migrated into eastern and central Russia, where most of their brothers and other relatives had also settled. Peoples descended anciently from Gomer and Magog and Tubal and Meshech and Ashkenaz and Togarma. These were all the posterity of Japheth, one of the three sons of Noah. Some of the offspring of Japheth also migrated to the east. I've actually wondered about one particular son whose name was Javan, J-A-V-A-N. The word is so close to Japan, J-A-P-A-N, that it has made me wonder if the two were not in some way connected. Javan's sons were Tarshish and Kittim, both of which are often portrayed in the Bible as associated with ships. And indeed, Japan has become perhaps the leading shipbuilding nation in the world, at least in terms of the size and quality of its merchant fleet. I'm not certain that a direct connection can be made here, but I share it with you just for whatever interest and value it may have. You may have more information on that than I do, but I think it's kind of interesting. The position and the power of Russia and her allies in the end time has perhaps gone, well, underappreciated, or at least degraded in the eyes of many. And I feel safe in saying that this federation of countries is going to play one of the most vital parts of God's latter-day prophetic scenario. It has been a common assumption by some, if not many, taught as a fact to many believers, that Russia would never be a real enemy and was not someone to fear. But there is really little basis for such a belief. Russia is still a great power with whom to be reckoned on the world stage. She still possesses by far the second largest nuclear arsenal on Earth. She is strongly allied with many strategic nations, both in Asia and in the critical area of the Middle East. And she is definitely of a different mindset than that of the West, something that may constitute a much more vital piece of the end time puzzle than might meet the eye. Russia has played very decisive roles in the past. It was her resistance to Napoleon's invasion in 1812 that demonstrated the French emperor's overextension and led to his ultimate defeat at the Battle of Waterloo. Her ability to withstand the military onslaught of Adolf Hitler's garrisons through the horrible winter of 1941 and 42 wreaked disastrous results on the German war effort on the Eastern Front. Russia has for years been an unpredictable nation, very much like her national symbol, the bear. An emblem, by the way, that just happened to be the mark of the ancient Medes. Not a lot is known about the Medes, and interestingly enough, Russia has remained something of a mystery to most people in the world as well. In the seventh chapter of the book of Daniel, the second of his four infamous beasts is a bear, if you will remember. Notice what is said about this world power. Now, this is in Daniel, the seventh chapter, verse 5. Daniel writes, "And behold, another beast, a second, like unto a bear, and it raised itself up on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh." If this passage is to be seen as relating to the second great world ruling empire in Nebuchadnezzar's dream of Daniel 2, then it would be representative of Medo-Persia, at least in its ancient interpretation and application. I think it should be of more than just passing interest that the second of the famous four horsemen of the apocalypse described in Revelation 6 is red in color, and its rider is said to be given a great sword and the power to take peace from the earth, language that is very similar to what is said of the bear in Daniel 7. It is also reminiscent of Ezekiel's famous prophecy against Gog and Magog, where God commands this great array of nations to literally invade and attack, after which he supernaturally destroys them. Remember that Magog and the other peoples that are mentioned in Ezekiel 38 are relatives of the Medes, and that this is clearly an end-time pronouncement. Notice, in Ezekiel 38, verse 2, just to read a few verses here to confirm this, "Son of man, prophesy against Gog of the land of Magog, the chief prince who resides over the nations of Meshech and Tubal. Give him this message from the sovereign Lord. Gog, I am your enemy. I will turn you around and put hooks into your jaws to lead you out to your own destruction. I will mobilize your troops and cavalry, and I will make you a vast and mighty horde, all fully armed. Persia, Ethiopia, Libya will join you too with all their weapons. Gomer and all their hordes will join you, along with the armies of Togarmah from the distant north and many others. Be prepared, you and all the company that is assembled with you, and be on guard. Days you shall be visited. In the latter years you shall come into the land." It's the chief prince who rules over the nations of Meshech and Tubal. In the word R-O-S-H, and it can mean chief or head. It's also the name of a son of Benjamin, and possibly of a foreign country or people. If the experts who feel that the term Rosh should be interpreted as a place name are correct, then the passage in Ezekiel 38 takes on even more intrigue, because the word Rosh, R-O-S-H, could well be connected with the name Russia, because there is a similarity, an etymological similarity. The Ezekiel prophecy could well be referring to an end-time coalition of Eastern and Northern Asian and Middle Eastern countries, and although this particular military action that is discussed in chapters 38 and 39 is is somewhat outside the scope of this message, it is an important part of Scripture that is clearly applicable to the latter days, certainly has much in common with the timing of Christ's second coming. Because there's a comparison you can make with the language in Revelation 19 and Ezekiel 39 that's very similar. Now, here I'm going to read it in Revelation 19, verse 17. I saw an angel, John writes, standing in the sun, and he cried with a loud voice, saying to all the fowls that fly in the midst of heaven, come and gather yourselves together unto the supper of the great God, that you may eat the flesh of kings, and the flesh of captains, and the flesh of mighty men, and the flesh of horses, and of them that sit on them, and the flesh of all men, both free and bond, both small and great. This is a description of that time when the Messiah comes out of heaven and the armies of heaven are with him. This is after the fall of Babylon, which is described in Revelation 18. Now, compare that with Ezekiel 39, beginning in verse 17. And you, son of man, thus says the Lord God, speak unto every feathered fowl, and to every beast of the field, assemble yourselves and come. Gather yourselves on every side to my sacrifice that I do sacrifice for you, even a great sacrifice upon the mountains of Israel, that you may eat flesh and drink blood. You shall eat the flesh of the mighty and drink the blood of the princes of the earth, of rams and of lambs and of goats and of bullocks, all of them fatlings of Bashan. And you shall eat fat till you are full, and drink blood till you be drunken of my sacrifice, which I sacrificed for you. Thus you shall be filled at my table with horses and chariots and mighty men, and with all men of war, says the Lord God. These two passages are both clearly in time in their setting and remarkably similar in their language. I believe that they definitely deserve closer scrutiny by all believers today. But getting back to the subject of our discussion, the bear as a symbol and the color red seem to be associated with the Medes, and both of these are known to be connected with Russia as well. In fact, the color red is identified with the entire communist philosophy and movement throughout Russia, China, and other allied countries. It's very interesting that Moscow, the capital of Russia, is historically known as the Third Rome. Why such an unusual designation? The First Rome was and is in the nation of Italy. We all know that. It was from there that the western portion of the Roman Empire was controlled. But don't forget that the city of Constantinople in Turkey was considered the Second Rome, named in honor of the Emperor Constantine, and became the capital of the Roman Empire as well. It was where the Emperor Justinian lived and from which the Holy Roman Empire was launched about 554 AD. Constantinople was the home of the Greek Orthodox Church and later became the capital of the famous Byzantine Empire. After the fall of Byzantium, scholars and historians have traced the movements of its leaders and culture to guess where? Of all places, Moscow in Russia. Indeed, the Russian Orthodox Church became the religion of the land. Even the architecture of Constantinople can be seen today in Red Square, with its temples and turrets and towers and minarets. As many of you know, the very term Tsar is but a version of the word Caesar. And interestingly enough, the last ruling family of Imperial Russia was the Romanov dynasty, which means the House of Rome. Dr. Peter Charanis, who is the Voorhees Professor of History at Rutgers University, makes the following statement, I think, that ought to be of interest to all of us, as it touches directly on the very subject of this present discussion. Speaking of the Byzantine Empire, Dr. Charanis has the following to say, and I quote, the synthesis of cultures dominated by Christianity, Byzantium passed on to surrounding barbarians such as the Balkan Slavs and the Russians, and so made civilized nations out of them. With the fall of the Byzantine capital, Byzantium had ceased to exist as a political entity. As heir to and preserver of the cultural traditions of the ancient Greco-Roman world, and as the bridge between that world and the modern world that grew out of the Renaissance, Byzantium had fulfilled its historical role. One Orthodox Christian state, however, still kept its independence. The conquerors of Byzantium had scarcely given a thought to Russia. In many ways, the principal heir to the historical mission of Byzantium, it was to Byzantium that Russia owed its conversion to Christianity. Dynastically, the claim could be supported by the fact that Ivan III of Moscow had married Princess Sophia, the daughter of the last king of the house of Palaiologos in Byzantium. But as with Byzantium itself, what was more important than a dynastic link was the force of the idea of the mystical vision of a shared Christian society under the rule of a single semi-divine emperor. This led to the assumption by the Russian ruler of the imperial Byzantine title of autocrat, to the modeling of the Russian coronation ceremony on the Byzantine example, and to the adoption by the Russians of the double-headed eagle of the Byzantine House of Palaiologos. The historical implementation of the ideas of the theocratic state inherited from Rome and given a Christian form by the Byzantine Empire lasted until July 16, 1918. On that night, the last Russian Tsar, Nicholas II of the House of Romanov, and his family were murdered by the Bolsheviks at Ekaterinburg, and after 1600 years, the Byzantine political heritage had come to an end. End of quote. I think that's a fascinating bit of commentary, just as an aside, and to demonstrate how intertwined royal lineages and aristocratic, I guess you could say, cooperation can be. Please remember that Tsar Nicholas II, who was the famous Nicholas of Nicholas and Alexandria, we all are familiar, the last of the Tsars, the one that was murdered, Nicholas II, was the first cousin of the Prince of Wales, who later became King George V of England, and Tsarina Alexandra was the granddaughter of Queen Victoria. That's an astounding fact. Note carefully the mention of the double-headed eagle in the statement that I just read you of Dr. Peter Tirani. This figure was taken directly from Constantine to Moscow, where it was incorporated into the Great Seal of Russia. Let me correct myself. I should have said that figure was taken directly from Constantinople to Moscow, where it was incorporated into the Great Seal of Russia, until it was replaced by the infamous hammer and sickle of the communist. It remained the dominant symbol of Imperial Russia. And it is very interesting that since the dissolution of the USSR, the hammer and sickle is no longer the official seal. But guess what is? I mean, guess what is the official seal of Russia today in the 21st century? You probably have guessed it. It is the double-headed eagle, each face looking in the opposite direction, with the image of, you'll never guess what, St. George slaying the dragon in the middle of the seal. St. George! I mean, how could St. George riding a white horse and slaying the dragon be on the official Russian seal? Well, folks, I have a secret to share with you. Russia didn't get this symbol only because of its Greek Orthodox Christian heritage. that became the Russian Orthodox Church. Believe it or not, the warrior on a white steed slaying a dragon was on the coat of arms of none other than Cyrus the Great, the Medo-Persian ruler who conquered ancient Babylon. I have in front of me at this moment a copy of the cover of a recent roadmap of Moscow. It is entitled The New Moscow. The picture on the front is of the Cathedral of St. Basil, built in the 16th century by Ivan the Terrible. And flying above it is, guess what? That's right, St. George on his white horse slaying the dragon. That is on an up-to-date, brand-new map of the city of Moscow on the front cover. Is it just possible that the new and end-time destroyer of Babylon will be the modern-day Medes, who centuries ago migrated into Turkey, became part of the world-renowned Byzantine Empire, and then carried that culture into Russia, the very inheritor of Byzantium? Will the latter-day kings of the East be led by Russia and its powerful allies both in Asia and the Middle East? I think this ought to be a powerful possibility every one of us should seriously consider. Now, although this is outside the scope of our discussion, it's nevertheless very instructive that the color red is associated in the Bible with the man named Esau as well, who is the brother of Jacob. With respect to his birth, it is said in Genesis 25, and I'm going to start reading in verse 21, this is going back over the history of Esau and Jacob. In verse 21 of chapter 25 in Genesis, the Bible says, "And Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord was entreated of him, and Rebekah his wife conceived. And the children struggled together within her. And she said, if it be so, why am I thus? And she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said unto her, two nations are in your womb, and two manner of peoples shall be separated from your bowels. And when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red, all over like a hairy garment, and they called his name Esau. And Isaac loved Esau, because he did eat of his venison. But Rebekah loved Jacob. And Jacob sawed pottage, and Esau came from the field, and he was faint. And Esau said to Jacob, feed me, I pray you, with that same red pottage, for I am faint. Therefore was his name called Edom." E-D-O-M. Edom. It's very informative that the descendants of Edom are known to have later migrated into Asia Minor, especially to Turkey, whose chief city and capital at that time was Constantinople. If one reads the account of the biblical account of Esau's lineage in Genesis 36, it is evident that the leaders of the Edomite clans were known as dukes. This same term is to be found in the later history of Constantinople during the days of the Byzantine Empire, and even later in the various imperial Russian dynasties. Dukes and grand dukes populated the Russian dynasties in imperial Russia. Is there an Edomite connection with Russia? Historical evidence affirms that this is indeed so. In fact, the impact of Edomite influence in the world is greatly underestimated, allowing the descendants of Esau to carry on much of their, shall we say, dirty work in secret, because their true identity is simply not known by the overwhelming majority of the world's population. It is said that Jacob and Esau wrestled while still in the womb of their mother, Rebekah. There was, therefore, from the very beginning, a struggle between the two brothers, a confrontation that has, in fact, been going on for centuries and even millennia of time, and which just may play itself out in the latter days with the greatest and most destructive showdown in world history. of that time, God says, and this is in the first chapter of Obadiah, which is a short little book dedicated to a prophecy concerning Edom. Thus says the Lord concerning Edom, the pride of your heart has deceived you, you that dwell in the clefts of the rock whose habitation is high. How are the things of Esau searched out? How are his hidden things sought up? All the men of your confederacy have brought you even to your border. The men that were at peace with you have deceived you and prevailed against you, that they that eat your bread have laid a wound under you. And your mighty men, O Teman, shall be dismayed, to the end that every one of the mount of Esau may be cut off by slaughter. For your violence against your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you, and you shall be cut off forever. In the day that you stood on the other side, in the day the strangers carried away captive his forces and foreigners entered into his gates, you should not have looked on the day of your brother, in the day that he became a stranger. Neither should you have rejoiced over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction. Neither should you have spoken proudly in the day of distress. You should not have entered into the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Yea, you should not have looked on their affliction, nor have laid hands on their substance. Neither should you have stood in the crossway to cut off those of his that did escape. Neither should you have delivered up those of his that did remain in the day of distress. The day of the Lord is near upon all the heathen. As you have done, it shall be done unto you. And the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for stubble. And they shall kindle in them and devour them, and there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken it. And saviors shall come on Mount Zion to judge the mount of Esau, and the kingdom shall be the Lord's. As I said, I don't have time to go into the history of Esau and his descendants and their impact upon the world through history, but it is a most remarkable subject. Suffice it to say that there is enough evidence to make a convincing case for at least part of Russia being connected to a branch of the house of Esau. It is very likely that the fabled kings of the East referred to in Revelation 16 can in fact be identified with God's statements in Isaiah chapters 13 and 21 and Jeremiah 51 as the Medes. They were the original destroyers of ancient Babylon, and their descendants will again be used in the end time to put a horrible end to modern day Babylon. Now I want to stop for a moment. I want to kind of back up, maybe recapitulate, kind of put everything into perspective. First of all, I want to remind everyone that the premise of this whole discussion is to take a close look at the many Bible prophecies concerning Babylon, her supporters and her enemies, and compare them with the reality of world conditions as we see them unfolding today. In doing so, it has become obvious that end time Babylon will be, at one point, the single greatest nation on the face of the earth. She will be the world leader in military might, in wealth, in industrial capacity, in trade, in political influence, in scientific advancement and technology. She will be the praise and the admiration of all the nations. At the height of her power, no one will be able to make war against her. She will seem invincible, just like ancient Babylon was thought to be impenetrable. Indeed, no nation will have ever successfully invaded her borders. She will be the greatest latter-day trend-setting country in the world. It is said that all the nations will have been made drunk from her. In time, Babylon will be a proud nation, one who feels she has nothing or no one to fear. Remember that written on the forehead of the harlot in Revelation 17 is the word mystery. Babylon always has been and always will be ruled by a secret society. It is part of the way Babylon works. Always has, always will. Babylon is more than just a single nation, however. It is a system. It is indeed the embodiment of Satan the devil's methodology. It is a formula for control of the masses by the ruling power elite. The Babylonian system is the creation and tool of a select group of true insiders. This group has existed for centuries of time and has made numerous efforts to put into place a one-world government. It was Satan's desire in the pre-flood world, and God was forced to destroy his own creation to stem the tide of corruption and domination by Satan and those who were directly empowered by him. It was attempted again at the time of the infamous Tower of Babel, which in fact commemorates the founding of Babylon itself. During the time of Nimrod, God once again took a direct hand in human affairs and scattered the people, lest he have to utterly annihilate everyone on earth for the second time. Throughout the millennia of time since then, there has always been an underground of secret societies that have been privy to information, to power, to money, and even to direct satanic involvement, and which have dedicated their entire existence to the establishment of a global government. Attempts to bring about a one-world government or a new world order, of course, have not always been successful. That's not important. The plans and the methods and the people involved still remain. And no matter how many setbacks may have occurred in the past, their determination has not been dimmed. Their dedication is to their God, and they know their God. He is real to them. They believe they are serving a higher power, and that they will be rewarded for their service. In many instances in past history, failed attempts should not really be viewed as such. In reality, most of these have been test cases or merely small parts of the overall plan. Since the time of the Crusades, particularly, the movement toward a one-world government has taken on much more serious proportions. The establishment of European secret societies at or just after that historical era has played a critical part in what has developed over the last few centuries with respect to the overall clandestine objectives. The implementation of Freemasonry, the founding of the Knights Templar, the secret creation of the Priory of Zion, the involvement of the black nobility of Europe, and the development of numerous connections among the aristocracy, the banking cartels, the occult society, and a spider's web of other underground conspiratorial groups all transpired at about the same time or point in history. And it's very crucial that we realize that. I'm at the end of side one of the tape, so I'm going to stop here. If you'll just turn the tape over right where it is, we'll pick up on side two. Okay, let's pick up where we were. The Babylonian system is the means utilized by the powers that be to control peoples and nations. So just to think of Babylon strictly in terms of a single country can be somewhat misleading. There is no question that in the end time the Babylonian mysteries is going to be firmly in play. If we were to assess the scriptural descriptions of latter-day Babylon and apply them to current world conditions and the present geopolitical reality, we might well conclude that the single nation that most completely fulfills the biblical requirements is the United States of America. In fact, she would have no real rival based upon the premise that I stated. This does not mean, however, that America is definitely Babylon, because, quite frankly, we simply do not know for certain if today's world is precisely in that final generation that will literally witness the long prophesied day of the Lord and the return of the Messiah to this earth. Were it to be so, then the United States would seem to be the unchallenged contender to fulfill the end time prophecies of Babylon. That really shouldn't sound that far out to anyone. The reason I say this is because we need to clearly understand that there is a distinction made in the Bible between Babylon and that infamous entity known as the beast. And many believers simply assume that they're one and the same. But this is not correct. Notice the following proof from Revelation 17, beginning in verse 1. Revelation 17, verse 1. And there came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials and talked with me, saying unto me, Come hither, I will show you the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman. But the woman was seated upon a scarlet colored beast, full of the names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And upon her forehead, the woman's forehead, was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. The woman is Babylon. She is not the same entity as the beast. Rather, she is pictured as riding the beast, or perhaps better said, as being supported by the beast. The fact is made clear that Babylon is a tool or a weapon that is being used by the beast. What that use, or should say when that use, has been fulfilled, guess what happens? Well, the answer is found right in the same 17th chapter of Revelation, beginning in verse 12. In Revelation 12 we read, And the ten horns which you saw are ten kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind, and they shall give their power and strength to the beast. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And the ten horns which you saw upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God has put in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled. And the woman which you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. I wonder how long it has been since you noticed the significance of that passage. The beast power is clearly distinguished from the woman, or Babylon, and furthermore, the beast eventually turns against Babylon. How can this be? The answer may lie in determining just who the beast might possibly be. Again, I intend to base my comments on the premise that what we have seen in the past and what we currently see today are the major factors that will be taken into consideration. I am not attempting to give some personal prophecy for the distant future. I will leave that to those who think they are prophets. There are plenty of those around. Who could possibly fulfill the role of the beast, both in terms of a single individual as well as in terms of a political entity? I believe that this question must be approached from a very specific and hopefully correct perspective. For starters, what is the beast? It is obviously a political power. As to whether or not it should be accurately described as a single nation is perhaps doubtful. Personally, I am led to think of the beast in terms of power, knowledge, money, and the ability to control all things. It is unlikely that all of these have ever or will ever reside with just one person or just one country. There is, however, another way of looking at the situation. Instead of viewing the beast as a single nation with boundaries as we know it today, consider the possibility that what the Bible calls the beast is a coalition of financially dominant, politically powerful, highly placed, intimately informed insiders and institutions that transcend national boundaries, moral tenets, personal creeds, religious practices, and all legal restrictions. I don't know, maybe I ought to repeat that. Instead of viewing the beast as a single nation, consider the possibility that the beast is a coalition of financially dominant, politically powerful, highly placed, intimately informed insiders and institutions that transcend national boundaries, moral tenets, personal creeds, religious practices, and all legal restrictions. The fact that many of these individuals are a part of the cartel is a sign that they come from specific families that have a long history of involvement in such a group and its historical objectives. Others are part of the combine due to their current personal power or money or position or usefulness. It says that the 10 kings that are aligned with the beast in the end time previously didn't have a lot of power, but are given power with the beast for a short time in the end. This elite ruling class is composed primarily of Europeans and Americans. There are few, if any, Russians or Japanese. Really no Chinese or Africans to a great extent involved. If this confederacy of powerful individuals, royal families, banking cartels, and industrial giants is to be viewed as possibly constituting the beast in the end time, then America obviously is not the only nation upon which there should be a focus. Europe is also intimately involved. We all must remember that the United States, although it did win a war of independence from England, has never, ever truly been free from British influence and British power. And now it's true that the Prime Minister of Great Britain does not normally just call up the U.S. President and tell him what to do. But that's not how it works. The British maintain their control and involvement in ongoing global projects, not through military might, but through the power of money and because of the long-standing alliances that have been formed over the centuries with powerful friends in very high places. If America is indeed the likely end-time representation of Babylon, it is because the beast sees in the United States a tool with which it can bring about world government. The Babylonian system works better in America than in any other society on earth today. And why is this? Simply because it is able to be hidden here better than anywhere else. What America ostensibly presents to the world looks and sounds so good. It's inimitable. I mean, everyone wants what America has. It does not appear that she is controlled by and is the greatest sponsor of Babylonianism in the world. In keeping with the development of America by the beast power as the center of attention and attraction in the end time, it is not surprising to find that in the 20th century, by far the greatest strides forward toward the creation and establishment of a one-world government have been made in and through the United States of America. The institution of the Federal Reserve System in the early 1900s, modeled on the already well-established and ensconced central banks of Europe, was perhaps the opening shot in what is proving to be the final phase of a push toward global domination. The infamous secret meeting on Jekyll Island, Georgia, in 1909 of America's most powerful financiers and their European counterparts or representatives paved the way for the formation of the Federal Reserve System of the United States. The power of central banks cannot possibly be overestimated. They have changed the face of the world over the last 200 years. They have financed virtually all of the major wars and most of the minor ones in the 19th and 20th centuries, often supporting both sides simultaneously and creating for themselves incredible profits in the process. They have created and bankrolled innumerable think tanks and policy-making institutes, scientific research centers, and other organizations staffed with experts and designed expressly to originate plans for world domination under the guise of the seemingly harmless task of solving the various problems of the nation or the world. They have sponsored philosophies and approaches of esteemed thinkers whose teachings espoused or contributed to the steps toward one world government. They have been responsible for creating both capitalism and communism, even though these concepts appear to be at odds with one another, and certainly have played out that way on the ostensible world scene. In fact, this policy of creating opposing forces through which the masses can then be propagandized and indoctrinated is one of the chief ploys of this ruling power elite. America's Federal Reserve System has been successfully manipulated through the years since its inauguration to totally control the economy of this country and much of the rest of the world. Through the aegis of the Federal Reserve Board and its satellite branch banks, America's economic fortunes have risen and fallen at the whim of those whose long, powerful tentacles reach into the corridors of power and influence in this nation and even throughout the world. Depressions, recessions, inflations, and times of economic recovery all are the created product of these manipulators who, because they are in the know, reap billions of dollars in profit no matter which way the economy turns. Even though the Babylonian system originated elsewhere, it is through the United States of America that it has found its most productive home, and this country has been and is being utilized as a weapon against all the opponents of world domination. The ill-fated attempt to form the League of Nations just after the conclusion of World War I was the product of this hidden potential beast power. President Woodrow Wilson was portrayed as the architect of this 20th century version of world government, although its form and shape came from a much higher powered source. It was hoped that the First World War would guarantee the formation of the League of Nations, but it didn't really work out that way. In fact, the United States Congress actually voted against America's participation in this agreement. But that did not stop the instigators. A major depression followed by a second world war would finally set the stage for success in this high-level endeavor. In 1945 in San Francisco, the victory was achieved with the creation of the United Nations, an entity that was accomplished in one American city and established in another, New York City. The very land upon which its headquarters was built being donated by the generosity of none other than the Rockefeller family. The United Nations for years seemed to be an organization in title only. You know, that is a fact. Almost no thought was given to it by the average person for years. But during that time, appearances were not really what they seemed to be. They were, in fact, quite deceiving. Who do we assume created and ran the so-called Cold War? Who do we believe was used to promote the great divergence between the East and the West? Folks, remember this one thing. When it comes to the way this world is run, nothing, absolutely nothing, is left to chance. Nothing happens without a purpose. Nothing is done without a plan. In order for the global planners to succeed, it is necessary that they create opposing philosophies and methodologies in the world. I believe this is called the Hegelian dialectic. Dividing the nations into various ideological camps is part of the program. Where did we suppose that communism came from? Did it just suddenly spring to life one day in 1917? Of course not. Such a notion is absurd. Communism is a created entity. And remarkably, it was created by the capitalists. The Bolshevik Revolution was engineered by operatives of the ruling power elite in the world at that time. The rise to power of people like Lenin and Stalin was well planned not by Russian peasants, but by well-heeled, well-entrenched men operating behind the scenes. For anyone interested in learning the real truth about how this most intriguing piece of history developed, you ought to read the book entitled Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution by Dr. Anthony Sutton of Stanford University. He not only has written the definitive exposé of the European-American connection, both to the planning and the financing and the execution of the plan to impose communism upon a great portion of the world, but also the essential background on how this very same group of powerful people backed Adolf Hitler's rise to power in Germany and bankrolled both sides in the Second World War. It's one of the most incredible, remarkable stories in all of human history, and it provides enough clear evidence for concerned, thinking people to wake up and realize that now, more than ever before, there is a movement afoot by potent forces to accomplish and finish what their predecessors started long ago, namely the complete domination of the world, its people, its resources, its money, and its fate. God long ago foresaw the development of this effort, and to what depths it would go to achieve its ends, and to what heights it would rise in the success of its operation. He inspired writers like Daniel and John to call this end-time alliance the beast. Think about that term for a moment. God calls this thing a gruesome, many-headed, multi-horned dragon, a ferocious, fire-breathing, satanically empowered reptile of unprecedented strength, wealth, and influence in the world. This is not something that God takes very lightly. It is a horrifying creature from the depths of hell, and it is going to dominate the peoples of the earth. You and I need to make ourselves acutely aware of just how specific God is in describing this entity, how much emphasis He puts on its development, how it will come about, what its motives and plans will be, who will lead it, what it will achieve, and what its ultimate destiny is going to be. We really need to take it very seriously, in fact, and realize that the world in which we live today is the breeding ground, or may well be the breeding ground, for this end-time monster. Whether it comes to complete fruition in our generation is not the point. The plans are already afoot. The conspiracy is alive and well. The steps are being taken. The barriers to its success are being systematically broken down all around the world. Resistance to it is being weakened throughout the earth. The peoples all over the earth are being carefully programmed to accept what is coming. Do not expect the beast to come on the scene overnight. Do not think it will look like a dragon. On the contrary, it will look good and sound good. Churches will laud its efforts and the media will sing its praises. Much of what it hopes to accomplish will be done peacefully. Laws that are either already on the books or that will be subsequently passed, whether at a national or a global level, will simply become the accepted norm. Very few will object. Very few will protest. Very few will even perceive the evil intent of what is transpiring. Those who do oppose it, well, they'll be under suspicion and surveillance, branded as criminals, traitors, even as the enemies of God, and will end up suffering the loss of privacy, jobs, property, freedom, and perhaps even their very lives. It is coming. The seeds have long ago already been sown, and soon it will be full-blown in this world. It is high time for all of us to get rid of our naivete, our unfounded bias against what is happening, and reject the words of appeasement and peace and security that proceed out of the mouths of everyone from politicians to your local church minister. Okay. I've said a lot. But what am I saying? Just this. That if we were to take the history of the last 200 or so years and bring it all up to this very moment in time based upon the description of the Bible and the realities of the world situation, both known and hidden, the beast would consist of a coalition of the most well-entrenched, powerful, connected, richest men and families, primarily in Europe and America. In many instances, they come from a long line of powerful forces that have learned over generations of time how to leverage control on a massive scale. The ability of this coalition to achieve power on a world stage will have developed not at the last moment in history, but over time. The Babylonian system is the approach they prefer to work through in accomplishing their objectives. This system grips virtually all countries in the world today and at every level of society. It is the web of deception and control that Satan has cast over the peoples of this earth. Throughout the 20th century, this powerful cartel, always or generally always running things from behind the scenes, has cultivated especially the United States of America with all of its resources and prepared her for the ultimate role in their evil schemes. Remember that Babylon sits astride the beast. They are not the same entity. Babylon is a harlot who will do anything to satisfy her needs and appetites. And, like a prostitute, she is the one being used by the beast. This is the position America finds herself in at this very moment. The United States of America, that place on earth where the Babylonian system is most successfully entrenched, fits the biblical description of Babylon today more than any other nation or society on the face of the earth by a ratio of at least 10 to 1. There can be, in fact, little or no dispute over the truth of that statement. Could things drastically change? Yes, possibly so. But that's not the premise of this message. Consider these things. Watch, wait, see what happens. But consider them. Keep them in mind. Babylon will flaunt itself in front of the whole world. All the nations will desire to go to bed with her. She will export her wretched brand of lifestyle to every one of her lovers and contaminate them all. Babylon will become the richest, most glamorous, honored, praised, and desired nation on earth. She will make the rest of the world rich. Her voice will be loud in the affairs of men. On her soil, the beast will establish a system of control that will directly affect the entire world. It will be a gathering of the nations to Babylon and a means by which the beast can exercise control. This very system of control is already in place and powerfully at work. Even as I speak, you know what it is, and you know where it is. Just as the United Nations fulfills its role, so does NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. There are numerous treaty agreements throughout the world, but none that even remotely has the power, connections, and means to equal NATO. If you noticed how NATO was used in Bosnia and Serbia, you will get an idea of how she operates. NATO has both a political and a military side to it. Most people are really only familiar with the military alliance, ostensibly established to withstand the threat of communism in Europe. But NATO is also one of the major think tanks in the world where actual policy is formulated and carried out. To discover who the individual non-military members of NATO would shock most people. Suffice it to say that NATO is one of the most powerful tools in the hands of the Anglo-American ruling elite and will probably play an even greater role in the future. You know, I was listening recently to Vice President Al Gore. This was just a couple of days ago, speaking to the UN Security Council on the subject of AIDS in Africa. You may have picked it up, too. I think I saw it on CNN or C-SPAN. His speech was literally laced with statements about and references to the absolute need for global control of all human needs. The talk concerning a one-world government is commonplace today, especially among those who walk in the corridors of power. It cannot really even be hidden any longer. You see it, as I said, on CNN and C-SPAN all the time. Start making an effort to view what you hear and see from the perspective of the global planners. Otherwise, it will go right over your head, which is just what Babylon hopes will happen anyway. Babylon, as great as it is still only something that is used. In coming to my conclusions in this matter, I have not discarded my personal belief that America is part of latter-day Israel. Don't get me wrong. I'm simply saying that the scriptures reveal that God's people, both physically and spiritually, will be in Babylon in the end time. Our peoples and those of Europe as well are pawns in the game. We are part of the nameless, faceless masses, a series of numbers in the computer bank, the butt of the most colossal and hideous joke of the ages. We are prisoners of Babylon, enslaved to her system of control. In time, that system will turn even uglier, and the results will be catastrophic. The sins of America and Europe are a horrifying stench in the face of God, and they will not go unpunished. Babylon will have an enemy in the world, and once the plot is hatched, she will be vulnerable and at risk. When she is fully drunk on her own power and riches, the enemy will strike. The handwriting will have been on the wall, but she won't even have seen it coming. She won't know what hit her. The beast itself and those who are allied with it will finally come to hate Babylon. And just as a harlot is used and then cast aside, so will Babylon be treated by those who created it. The kings of the east will be stirred up by God and used as a weapon in his hand to bring down the great wall of Babylon and destroy this ultimate system of evil foisted off on all of the world. In the end, however, God himself will eradicate all human power, all human authority, religion, and resistance, and establish his eternal kingdom upon this earth, and Jesus Christ will return and achieve ultimate victory over all the efforts and agendas of human beings. The fate of the beast is to be cast alive into the lake of fire. This will occur at the return of Christ to this earth. Its demise will signal the utter destruction of evil upon this planet. Unraveling the details of how the beast operates is a daunting task. I am not an expert in doing so. I do know certain things, others know much more. I do believe that the jigsaw puzzle can be pieced together with great patience, time, and insight. It is, at the least, a very fascinating and revealing experience. The system that is going to rule this world will be an intricate, intertwined, tangled network, a veritable spider's web, whose real sources of power will be hidden, whose real motives will be secret, whose manner of operation will be deceptive, and yet whose appearance will look good, at least at first. Eventually, many will come to perceive the evil that will have been perpetrated upon this hapless world. No matter how much religion is involved in end-time Babylon, she will be the enemy of the true God. Please remember that the way of Satan is not what it appears to be. When the Bible states in the book of Revelation that ultimately he will deceive the whole world, it means that he will have been successfully accepted by all without having been recognized for who and what he really is. What is at work behind the scenes on the world stage is not what it appears to be. It never really has been. The beast will not look like a monster, and Babylon will not appear to be a harlot. Black will be white, and day will be night. The Bible tells us this. We need to get ready for it in our own personal lives. Start looking at all things that are predicted in the scriptures from this perspective. Start viewing all things that transpire in the world from that perspective. You do not have to be deceived. And the things that are prophesied in the scriptures to come upon this world unawares need not do so to you or me. If you have not listened to our series of tapes entitled The Specter of Globalism, you might find the information on them useful in better understanding how things have been developing in this world during the 20th century to bring the earth to the brink. If you are interested, just request them. I think there are 8 tapes in the series, and as always, there's not any cost or obligation whatsoever. But if you desire to look deeper into what really makes this world tick, what it has accomplished, where it's going, I will suggest several books that you might read that should prove intriguing and valuable in helping to sort things out. One such book I've already mentioned, and that is Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution by Dr. Anthony Sutton. Other pertinent works by Dr. Sutton include the companion volume, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, as well as America's Secret Society. Another one is Technological Treason. Another one is How the Order Creates War and Revolution. And there is another one entitled The Diamond Connection, which has to do with the Oppenheimer diamond cartel, the De Beers diamond cartel, which is a fascinating story, one that actually pulls the veil off of so much of the secret underpinnings of what is going on in the world. It is an amazing story. In addition to the writings of Dr. Anthony Sutton, some of the works of Eustace Mullins could be recommended. They would include The World Order. Another one is Murder by Injection. And a third one is Secrets of the Federal Reserve. Former Romanian Prime Minister Michael Sturdza has written an excellent expose entitled Betrayal by Rulers, as has Dr. John Coleman in his intriguing book, Diplomacy by Deception. There are other good sources. There are other bad sources, you know. Unfortunately, much of what has been written with respect to a one-world government or the so-called New World Order is poorly documented, far too speculative, almost always either incomplete or shallow, and generally unscholarly in its quality. Anyone studying the subject has to be very careful to sift out the truth from the fiction. Well, in closing, let me just say it's my sincere hope that this series on Babylon will provoke you to at least think about and read about and pray about these things more seriously than ever before. Some of you will not agree with some of the conclusions I reach. Later study may reveal to me that I might have been wrong on any number of points. I'm not preaching to you in that sense. I'm not insisting that you accept a certain doctrine here. I am just sharing with you what I feel to be interesting and vital information that can be used, that can be studied into, that can be at least remembered as we watch and wait for the unfolding of world events. We all need God's guidance and closeness now more than ever before. The times in which we live today are, as I have said so many times, dangerous, deceptive, and difficult. And they will get worse. You and I, brethren, must be prepared to stand. Before I completely sign off, I would like to mention the fact that I have just heard that Lon Lacey died very suddenly a couple of nights ago. I think he was exercising and had a heart attack from what I've read. I certainly want to send condolences to his family and to his close friends and supporters who undoubtedly are in a state of shock and great pain and agony. We all know that death comes to us. I have faced death myself on a number of occasions, and it is a part of the whole process. But sudden death can be shocking, and it always has that element of emotion and sadness in it. So if you knew Lon Lacey, he had a tape ministry, as some of you might know, or if you encountered him, he was a minister in, I believe, the Worldwide Church of God for some years. If you knew him or knew of him, I'm certain that you want to be informed of that and to be praying for his family, for God to comfort and strengthen them in the time of this trial and of this loss. Thanks a lot.